Welcome back to Slightly Foxed in festive Hoxton Square. We have an intriguing discussion for you this time, and it's a subject that all of you as real readers will have your own thoughts about. What sparks a lifelong love of reading? Now, presumably nature and nurture must play a role, but what's the alchemy that makes it happen? And what does a passion for reading bring to our lives? We're recording, as always, around the kitchen table, so please do forgive the usual noises off from the team and possibly the dogs. My name is Philippa Lamb. Co-editors and founders of Slightly Fox, Gail Perkis and Hazelwood, are here, along with Hattie Summers. Shortly, we'll be joined by two guests, but before I introduce them, let's have our regular briefing on what's happening here at the magazine this month. So, Hattie, I could barely get through the door this morning. There's so many boxes of books in here. It's crazy busy right now.
Yep, very much in the throes of Christmas, mailbags kind of coming out of our ears. We get two collections of posts a day just to get everything kind of out of the door in time.
When's the deadline? Can people still order if they want to?
Certainly, yes, particularly Western Europe and the UK. You know, we'll be going right up until the end of the week when the office shuts for Christmas on the 20th.
And if they really miss the boat, you've got a little sneaky trick.
Well, yeah, absolutely, especially, you know, rest of the world. So if you've got that, you know, aunt in Canada or something you need to send something to, you can do an email gift card on the website and the physical item will arrive when we're back in the office in January.
Excellent. Okay, Hattie, I'm not going to keep you any longer. Thank you very much. Back to the boxes.
Indeed.
So, on to this month's guests, who are the historian and novelist Frances Spufford, author of The Child That Books Built, and Emily Drabble, head of books at the charity Book Trust. The piece from the Slightly Foxed archive this time is about reading aloud by Isenda Maxton Graham. As always, we'll have reading recommendations from everyone towards the end of the podcast. But now, to discuss sparking a love of reading, I'm delighted to welcome our guests, Frances Spufford and Emily Drabble. Now, Frances, you're an author, fiction and non-fiction. Great success in 2016 with a really remarkable historical novel called Golden Hill. And you teach creative writing at Goldsmiths College here in London. I know you've thought deeply about this question we're discussing today because you did write a book about it.
I did. I was the kind of reading child who does it to such a degree that adults worry faintly. So voracious that I kind of could only be parted from books with difficulty. And I wrote this kind of memoir called The Child That Books Built a few years ago, which was an attempt to work out why I'd come out like that.
I don't think you're alone around the table.
I hope not.
Emily, tell me about Book Trust.
Book Trust is the UK's largest children's reading charity. We're all about trying to encourage more children, all children, to become readers because we know that those children will do better in life, whatever their socioeconomic background. So we reach 3.9 million children a year with books, resources. We give 700,000 babies books, and then we reach them again when they're three, again when they're five. It's often the first book that they've ever owned, that's even in their house. We think it's that starting early, shared reading, reading with your family, that's the thing that's most likely to engender a love of books.
So you work through schools and local authorities, do you?
Yes, to deliver those books.
Shall we start with the first books you all recall reading as children, or indeed having read to you, Frances?
This is slightly embarrassing. The first book I ever read for myself was Tolkien's The Hobbit. In my defence, I had mumps at the time and was bedbound for a while, and it wasn't competing with anything else. But I can remember not being able to read on the first page of The Hobbit and it flowing along faster and faster until I wasn't really aware I was reading anymore by the end of it.
What about you, Emily?
Well, I really remember learning how to read. I remember being in the library when I must have been like five or six and suddenly it all making sense. And from then on, a whole world opened up for me. I think I, in common with lots of, I'm aged 49, I had quite a boring life and I never really did anything apart from read. The book that most seems like a bit of a slight book, it's the Ginny books by Patricia Leach. I don't know if anyone's ever read them. And I've got my copy here, which is For the Love of a Horse. It looks like a normal horse book, but it's
picture of a horse on the cover.
I was just like a working class London girl. I never went anywhere near a horse, but I loved these books. But when I reread them as an adult, I realised they had fundamentally changed my life. It was actually a freaky and creepy experience because the girl is not posh. There's a lot of stuff about vegetarianism. I'm a vegetarian, the only one in my family. I just feel like all my politics and everything that I am honestly came from this book and no one's ever heard of it.
Gail, do you remember?
I was sent back from Singapore as a child to go to boarding school, aged 7. My mother packed the Christmas presents at the bottom of my bag. And I remember sitting in bed on Christmas morning and opening a copy of Swallows and Amazons. And I was completely and utterly entranced. I think my sort of fascination with sailing started from that. The sense of adventure, a world that I had no knowledge of. And when my children were small, I went back to read them. And they still have the same magic.
What about you, Hazel?
When I was very small, I mean, possibly 5 or 6, my father, who actually had polio when he was at university and was in a wheelchair, so he was always available for reading, I remember him reading Dickens to me. And I found it both gripping and also terrifying. I remember hiding behind the chair for the bits where I could sort of put my fingers in my ears. But at the same time, it was so totally gripping, these vivid sort of characters.
It's very odd. About a year after coming back from Singapore, we stayed with a family for a year who had an attic full of old books. But I did discover a couple of junior encyclopedias of history. And I read those from cover to cover again and again and again. And I went on to read history as a degree.
I'm intrigued by this because I grew up in a house full of books, and I've always thought that's why I was such a reader. But I wonder whether the availability of books is such an issue for young people now, because obviously devices, do you think it matters?
I think there's an element of physical seduction which comes from books as objects. You can't smell a Kindle. But I also grew up during the great heyday of Puffin books. And Puffin books were incredibly reliable. And most of the great children's writers of the 1970s were all being published by Puffin. Joan Aitken, Peter Dickinson, Rosemary Sutcliffe, just in a row. And you could not go wrong by spending your 17.5p, 3 shillings and 6p, on any of them.
I mean, I know we all want this discussion to range a bit wider than, you know, how do you get children to read? But, I mean, Emily, that's what you deal with all the time. Does the physicality of books have anything to do with that now, do you think?
I think it does. I mean, obviously, picture books, they don't work on the Kindle. So all that shared reading really needs to be done with a physical book. And actually, children, even teenagers, don't use that many e-readers.
I could come up with an instant theory about this.
Go on.
Maybe technically minded adults like the idea of one device, which is a doorway to everything. But maybe where children are concerned, it really matters that each book is a separate doorway, that there is something about a book making a specific promise to take you there.
I like that theory.
But also children's books are so inventive. You know, there are the Spot books where you can lift the flap, you know, where's Spot? There are the books where you can touch the furry rabbit or slimy snake. So the child is actively involved.
Is this a big part?
It is a big part. Reading stories in whichever way is going to be beneficial for children, but to actually cozy up with a book is going to be more special.
I do notice when I'm reading to the grandchildren, they like to sort of snuggle up and put their arm around you. There's something about the particular experience.
Yes, actually reading the pictures, it's just as important
together.
As reading the words anyway. Yeah.
And then you have conversations which go out from the book, don't they?
Yes,
and
often
and then come back into
apparently
it.
Sort of irrelevant, but not.
Let's talk about libraries. We all know libraries are disappearing, mostly, though there obviously are some still being built. We all bemoan it. Does it matter?
It really, really matters, especially for children whose families can't afford to buy books, which is actually a lot of children in the UK.
Books aren't cheap.
And lots of families won't be able to prioritise buying books. They need libraries. And in fact, it's fascinating that you have to have a library in a prison, but you don't have to have a library in a school. And if you don't actually get a chance to browse and to choose your own books, it really, really impacts on your reading.
Now, I wanted to ask you about that, because I know you've got evidence about the benefits of reading, but also, I gather, those benefits only really apply if people choose their own books. So if it task reading doesn't do it.
No, absolutely. That's a big part of our programme, the Book Buzz programme. Choice is at the centre of that. So we select 17 books and then year 7 and 8 kids get to choose one of them. Then they get to own that book for their lives. But browsing and choosing is humongously important.
I mean, I know that British libraries have had a torrid time with budget cuts over the last couple of decades. Very, very short-sighted. But I suspect there has also been a slight misstep on the library's part themselves, that they set out to compete with bookshops, which is something they cannot do as well. Whereas what is deeply precious about a library is that it doesn't just have this season's new exciting stuff. It has previous years' exciting stuff arranged in all the glorious haphazardness of the alphabet so that children's fingers can just wander onto it.
Tell us about this data that I was reading. I think I read about it on your website, about reading for pleasure regularly and lower levels of depression.
Yes, one third of parents of children aged 4 to 11 worry about their child's mental health at least once a week. And now also 9 out of 10 parents say that they think reading together is a useful tool to open up conversations with their child, which is going to be really helpful. And yet, very sadly, 70% actually stop reading to their child by the time they're 7. But actually, it's so important to carry on reading with your child.
I got my son to start reading to me when he could read. So we reversed it.
Oh, I love sibling reading as well.
Yeah,
that's really nice.
Really fun. Let's talk about what we read, because it seems to me, Francis, there's obviously lots of opportunity for potential turn-offs to reading, alternative entertainments, that sort of thing. What about judgment? You know, this sense of what you should be reading and what people think about what you're reading.
Fatal. I think the sense that there is a kind of censor of good taste looking over your shoulder is one of the real deterrents to reading, which has to begin in pleasure if it's going to begin anywhere. And we need to be honest here about books being in some ways more difficult and asking more from us than other rival kinds of entertainment. There is a bigger upfront cost to sitting down and concentrating on a book. It doesn't come to you with colours and movement and whizzy stuff. And the payoff for you being prepared to do the imaginative engagement is that you then get a deeper engagement than anything you could get from, you know, almost anything but the very best film or TV, which means that what children need, in fact, what all of us need, is to find the end of the thread of pleasure and just follow it shamelessly wherever it goes. We are not supposed to be tediously trying to read the stuff that's good for us.
I didn't think you were a sci-fi fan.
And an unembarrassed one, because it gives me pleasure. And because it seems to me that the world is littered with different kinds of reading pleasures.
But there's also a trend, which I must admit I deplore, of feeling that you've got to have read the latest things and only the latest things. And if you're not up to date with all the books that are on the booker list or whatever, then somehow, you know, you're lacking.
Fashion, stuff it,
say. Yes, yes, no, I'm inclined to, well, of course, that's Slightly Fox, that's exactly what we do.
On the other hand, if the fact that the Booker shortlist is in the newspapers, if that's the prompt to go out and read some novels you wouldn't have read otherwise, then I'm very happy for that to work for people.
Hey, so what do you think, this definition of quality and trash? I mean, there's a middle-class consensus, isn't there, if we're honest?
Well, it's just making me think of my daughter growing up and the issues at home. I mean, my husband is rather an academic person, and when it came to Enid Blyton, because she read for years and years and years Enid Blyton and just wouldn't stop, we had an issue about that, and he kept trying to move her on, and I kept saying, no, you mustn't. And I think that did actually have an effect for a little while. You know, she felt she was being sort of overlooked and told what to read. I mean, what do you think
about... Does it matter, Emily? Does it matter what people read?
It really, really doesn't matter. And one of the saddest things you'll ever hear is if you pop into a bookshop and there's a child who wants to read picture books, when you hear people saying, no, come along, read a real book, read a proper book. Children should be able to read whatever they want to read. I remember that from when I was a child, a bit more snobbery about things. But I think that's largely gone, actually. I think people are just really happy if their child reads now. They're just like rejoicing about it.
Yes.
But I remember Mallory Blackman, when she was Children's Laureate, talking a lot about being really told off for reading comics, literally reading them in secret. And that, I don't think that would happen so much anymore. Children's books world has actually diversified, and there are so many amazing graphic novels. It feels like a golden age of children's books.
Yes. So legitimate literary choices, just forget about all that idea, it's nonsense.
But I think it is good to read out of your comfort zone. I mean, it's a bit sad
question.
If you're just reading the same author, which kids do get stuck on, say, the wonderful Diary of a Wimpy Kid books. And then they can almost think, I've read all them, now I've got nothing else to read. We actually have a column on the BookTrust website, which is what to read after those kind of series.
Also one of the areas in which one of those rare creatures, the children's librarian, can really help.
Exactly.
With the kind of, if you like this, then you might well like that.
It's a really good idea.
But this is a challenge for all of us, isn't it? I mean, as a grown-up, you get stuck in your comfort zone, don't you? I know I do.
Hazel and I certainly find that we're reading an awful lot of books from the past, but partly to decide what to reissue. And actually, I occasionally long for a new book.
I mean, would it be heresy to say that in the kind of foxed republished reads fit the kind of middle-class narrative? You know, people like us, white, middle-class, English. Do we read outside our own experience enough?
I think a lot of the books we publish are outside our own experience.
I think that, you know, you read the books that open new worlds to you, not just to read about your own particular milieu. So you're entering another person's world, and really which class they were in or which colour they were is immaterial.
But I do think you can get
frowning
stuck.
At me. I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Yes, I know you are.
Another way of putting it, maybe, is that diversity is a good thing, but it's possible to work with too narrow a definition of what diversity is and to forget that all of the layers of the past and all of those multiple lives in it themselves bring a huge amount of difference to us. Take the childhood of Rosemary Sutcliffe in the 1930s and 40s. Child in a wheelchair getting the world through books. I mean, that is strange to most of our experiences, and I don't think that strangeness is really reduced by us going, well, she was white and middle class. There are deep sources of difference and human adventure to be had which aren't necessarily captured by contemporary categories of difference.
Well, I'm from London and from a very kind of multicultural area of London, and I do think it's really important for people to read books by a wide variety of authors and with a wide variety of characters, because it's like a really sad thing if you don't see yourself reflected in a book, and it actually really can put you off reading. I feel very excited at the moment because there are so many great children's books being published. So, for example, there's a wonderful new publisher, Knights Of. So they're publishing mainly authors of colour. And one of the really interesting ones is Shana Jackson, who just wrote High Rise Mystery. I mean, it is set in a council estate, but it's actually not that gritty. Two young detectives, Nick and Norva, they just happen to be of colour. And that's actually quite revolutionary. So I feel like there are loads of books being published now, and I hope there's going to be loads more, because it has been a problem in children's publishing. We actually surveyed from 2007 to 2017 in conjunction with UCL, where we actually looked at the ethnicity of all the authors and illustrators, and we discovered that less than 2% were by British authors and illustrators of colour, considering 30% of children are actually of colour. But it is starting to happen, so I feel really positive about it.
And diversity in its wider sense. Social class as well, not
social
just ethnicity.
Class also,
yeah,
yes,
as you
which
say,
is very
kids from all over.
Yeah, it's weird because I'm born in 1970 and I went to school in London. I actually read really diversely. It must have been to do with my teachers at my school. I don't know, I read Farouk Dondi, and then I realised that that's hardly anyone else's experience.
I mean, particularly on children's books, you think of the children's books that we all read probably because our parents or grandparents read them. And I think there is a sort of a time lag, really, if one assumes that most immigrant families came here post-war. It's bound to take a few generations for people to evolve to get to the point where the classics of the future are being written.
Yeah, I think that's true. We're doing this great project called Book Trust Represents. We're actually working with aspiring authors and kind of opening doors, mainly what the project's about, and also going into schools and taking authors and illustrators of colour into schools so people can actually see that you could be an author or illustrator if you are a working-class kid and you are of colour. It's interesting, if you ask children to write their own book, even if they're of colour, they would often put a white child in the centre of the book.
Something similar applies to gender as well. I remember my wife saying that as an equally voracious reading child, she constantly, not with every book, but with a lot of books, had to do a kind of mental translation in which she would find a way to recognise herself within a male protagonist. Mm. And there is a real liberation in not having to do that anymore.
Yeah. I mean, we've had the occasional complaint from subscribers saying, oh, you know, there aren't enough books by women. You know, maybe that's the case, although we try hard to make things reasonably equal. But the fact of the matter is that over the last 2,000 years, far more men wrote books than women.
Because you're publishing on... you're concentrating on older work.
I mean, I just feel very... Well, Hazel and I both feel very strongly indeed. The important thing is it a good book?
Yeah.
I nearly agree.
Do you?
Because there's also different rates of forgetting when it comes to good stuff by men and good stuff by women. And one of the great things that happened in publishing and sort of towards the end of the 20th century was digging out just how many good things women had already written in series like the Virago series.
Absolutely.
Or now,
you're quite right.
Now
Persephone. Who featured on the podcast earlier in the year, actually, talking about that.
This just makes me think of, you know, how far back it goes. I absolutely adore the Ahlberg's books because very quietly they were doing just that, you know, Miss Brick the Builder's Book. baby.
I don't know these books.
Yeah. Oh, they're marvellous.
Lovely.
They're just so good, and they still last.
Janet, what was her husband called?
Janet Allen Alberg.
Allen Alberg, still creating.
Yes,
yeah. The Burglar Bell is a wonderful book.
And
yes.
My grandson absolutely adores it. I think he is stuck on that. But anyway, this sort of challenged all these things in the most humorous and quiet and funny way.
It's true. And actually, Shirley Hughes and Helen Oxenbury both did the same with characters of colour. Think of like a Helen Oxenbury so much. Yes. That she was Trish Cook's book that she illustrated, which is a black family.
Yes.
But for many children, that was the first time they ever saw themselves in a book.
Thinking about how the reading changes us as people, I was reading your book, Frances, The Child the Books Built, and I came across a quote that really spoke to me. It says, "Only the multiplicity of fiction is a problem. In a life where reading time is still limited, no matter how many commitments of work or friendship I am willing to ditch in favour of the pages." Tell us a bit more about what it was for you as a child, because you were an astonishingly deep reader.
I was partly in flight, though, because I had a seriously ill younger sister, so I had a motive of escape, and I particularly loved books about other worlds, because in those, the book as doorway worked most powerfully and literally. But I think it's just that I felt I had discovered the Universal Sweetie Shop, which contained things of every conceivable flavour. There are rival things out there in the world now that make it harder, I think, to do that kind of deep, completely unconditional dive into the written word.
The reading a book cover to cover as well, isn't it?
I was going to say, it's the hour. I used to often read for 4 hours. My children have never read, unless they're on holiday and there's no Wi-Fi, then maybe they would read 4 hours.
We go on holiday without devices for 2 weeks every year, and we get more read, all of us, in that fortnight than in any other fortnight of the year, because it's just not rivalrous with anything.
I think a lot of adults now, you know, find that it's very, very, as you say, very difficult to read. We had rather an interesting piece, didn't we, from a Canadian librarian who said that, you know, his life was so sort of busy, he actually didn't have time to read for himself, but he started reading again through reading children's books.
Yeah, I think if you work with books, that can be a problem. I've got a literary agent friend who says the same.
Some of the best read people I know are people whose day job has nothing to do with books.
Yes, I think that very much shows in our contributors, actually, because we did decide at the beginning that we weren't just going to have the usual suspects, as it were, writing about books. And we've had so many people who just do something completely different, writing really good pieces about the books that they love.
Well, I'm fascinated by your friend who was the librarian. I think, I mean, reading a lot of teen books, it does slightly kill adult books for me. That's what that I feel guilty about not reading, because I want to be like dragged into a book and I can't possibly pick my phone up because I'm completely immersed. So that's what children's authors do, because they know they have to drag those teenagers into the book. So the books I read are so compelling. I do often read books. I read in the bath and I often read a whole book. I often am laying in a freezing cold bath.
I do that too. Yeah. Yeah, there is. It's the ultimate luxury to be able to read a book cover to cover now, I think.
YA authors and children's authors are not embarrassed by plot. In fact, they know they have to do it. And one of the things I have loved over the last 20 or 30 years is that plot has returned to at least some adult fiction as well. It's stories not embarrassing anymore, but it could go further. I think that strong sense of being pulled through an invented world is something that more adult writers could learn from books.
Even in memoirs, when we come to decide which ones we think are worth doing, reissuing, the big question is always, has it got narrative drive? And basically, if you can't put it down, then you should reissue it. And this, of course, is in non-fiction. But how much more important is it in a novel?
Stories are the essential ingredient.
I've got a couple of questions I have to ask all of you to wrap this up. Rereading, yes or no?
Definitely.
Yes.
Oh, if only I had time. But yes.
Yes, quite. Yeah.
And the ultimate literary Marmite question, one book at a time or several?
Oh.
Several.
Me too.
In different places.
Yes.
So one by the bed.
Yes.
Possibly one in the bathroom. One in the kitchen.
Oh, no, one's for mood for me. I'll have a stack and you pick the one that matches your mood.
I love
when you
the
want
location.
To read.
I have to have one that I really, really love. I can't have two that I'm absolutely obsessed by at the same time.
No?
And then I'll have some, like, slightly more backburnery ones.
Well, I have a division in the house. Downstairs I have the books that I have to read. For slightly false.
Oh, for work, yes.
And upstairs in the bedroom, I have the books that I really want to read.
Is there any crossover?
Yes, actually, okay, there is sometimes really I find myself taking
books upstairs.
They can climb the stairs.
More do you treat? You have books in the kitchen.
Half our kitchen table is colonised by a kind of towering mass of books. I also have the category of the book I'm carrying around in my satchel, which is interesting and chewy, but slightly too dense to go on reading, so I can read a couple of pages of it before I start writing in the morning.
This isn't the book you want people to think you're reading that you take out and about.
No, this isn't. This is something without too much narrative drive, but which is interesting but not too interesting, so you don't absent-mindedly lose the writing day to reading instead.
Thank you, everyone. Let's move on to our monthly reading from the Slightly Fox back catalogue. What are we going to hear?
Yes, this is a particularly appropriate article. It's by Isenda Maxton Graham, and it's about reading aloud.
Where are we exactly? That is a question I've asked all too often. The scene? Three in a bed. Husband, 11-year-old son in the middle, me, dog asleep at the foot. The reason? Husband is reading aloud to us, and last night, as usual, I fell asleep towards the end of the chapter. Surely the most delicious kind of falling asleep is the gentle, helpless drifting off you do to the sound of the reading voice. The son is slightly exasperated at this question, as he never falls asleep while being read to. On the contrary, the story activates rather than lulls him. Mummy, honestly, don't you remember? They've just arrived at Helm's Deep. Of course, Helm's Deep. But just hearing those words brings on this evening's overwhelming sleepiness. Theoden, Denethor, what exactly is the difference between those two?
Tell the Iorid to assemble on the path and make ready to ride the Entwade.
You've lost me again, but it all sounds lovely. With one of our older sons, my husband walked the 155-mile London loop round the wooded edges of the metropolis, which took half a year of Saturdays. Reading The Lord of the Rings aloud to the youngest is the stationary equivalent of such a journey. A time-consuming adventure in which the partakers share every knoll and tussock. The nightly habit of reading aloud has become something the family depends on for equilibrium. Whatever happens in the husband's stressful job, whatever happens in the son's school day, whatever worries we all have, we know that before bedtime we will walk together into the world of a story we don't want to end. Just as he prefers to drive rather than be driven, my husband would rather read aloud than be read to. Both preferences suit me fine, as I hate getting back into the original lane after overtaking, and I get a sore throat after 2 pages of reading aloud. Over the past year, he's read the whole of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, followed by Watership Down, followed by The Odyssey. Each book has brought different delights and challenges. In The Lord of the Rings, one of the challenges is how to tackle the songs. You come across songs without warning on Tolkien's books. Turn a page and you're face to face with a long wad of italics divided into verses. You must quickly gauge whether this is a minor key song about loss or a major key one about merry feasts and invent a tune accordingly. And having invented it, you must remember it and repeat it in the next verse, a musical feat not made easier by the vocabulary Tolkien throws at you. Oh, arafane, lassi mista cani miere. Sometimes, when extremely yawny after a day of wrangling with Los Angeles lawyers, Michael has been known to substitute he said for he sang at the beginning and hope nobody notices. Imagined worlds work especially well as read aloud books. I must say, though, when Tolkien is being read aloud, it can sometimes be a bit like doing a long communal Ramblers Association trail in walking boots. Thousands upon thousands of words are devoted to the terrain, and Tolkien never allows you to forget whether his characters are trudging downhill or uphill. What the reader aloud and the read to look forward to most is when characters make their remarks in their own entirely distinctive fashion, and that's when the accents and voices come in. In Michael's case, the accents include Yorkshire, West Country, West Indian, Morningside, Glaswegian, Brummie and Cockney. The voices include military posh, schoolmaster disdainful, grandfatherly, regal, noble, good and true, boyish, and for girls, either girlish innocent or tomboy. Just as pianists say you can't hide when you're playing Mozart, authors know they can't hide when their books are being read aloud. Their stylistic bumps and infelicities are simultaneously aired and shared. Tolkien can get a bit biblical, but his Anglo-Saxon prose is music to the sleepy ears. The Lord of the Rings was always going to be a hard act to follow, and there was a sense of bereavement when the trilogy was finished. Michael decided on Watership Down, which he'd loved as a boy. The thick, puffin book sat unread on my bookshelf for years, because as a child I couldn't bear long descriptions of nature, and the novel starts with the sentence, "The primroses were over," and then proceeds to give us two slab-like paragraphs describing a ragwort, a brook, a brambly ditch, kingcups, watercress, a blackbird, and a warren at peace. The book is, in fact, a masterpiece. If only I'd got through that first page as a girl, I would have met Hazel and Fiver on page two. Richard Adams's chapters are shorter than Tolkien's, 5 to 10 pages, rather than 15 to 20. Short chapters are a good thing for bedtime reading. The reader aloud can conclude the evening's business with the words, "And here ends chapter 9, rather than having to say at an arbitrary moment, "Well, we'd better stop there. You really must go to bed. No, you really must, or you'll be exhausted. We'll read the rest of the chapter tomorrow, okay?"
That made me laugh, that thing about short chapters being great for parents, dare we say.
And you can always manufacture a kind of a cliffhanging ending somewhere in the middle of a chapter if you really have to. Your voice slows down in a kind of, "And we're reaching the point where this all comes to an end."
That only works if you haven't read the book before. That piece reading aloud was by author and columnist Lucinda Maxton Graham, and it was from Slightly Foxed issue number 40. Our thanks to Helen Bourne for reading it for us. Book recommendations from everyone shortly, but first, a brief word about the Slightly Foxed quarterly magazine. Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Okay, recommended reads from everyone. Emily.
I'm going to recommend a book. I'm actually only halfway through it, but that's why I'm recommending it. I know it's going to be brilliant. Okay. It's The Boy in the Black Suit by Jason Reynolds, an American author of colour. He's very famous in the States and not so famous here. And it is an absolutely brilliant story. I am just desperate to go and read it. And okay. All I can think about is finishing it. It's about a boy whose mother is dead and he gets hooked on going to funerals. He ends up working in a funeral parlour. He's 16.
Okay.
Oh, Jason Reynolds is just, you know, someone who never puts a word wrong and you're dragged straight into the story.
So you want to leave right now and finish it, basically, don't
you? I will
be. I can see it in your eyes, yeah. Gail?
Well, I'm rereading because I've been ill recently. I made the mistake of going back to what's actually a quintet of books, The Cazalet Chronicles by Elizabeth Jane Howard. I'm now up to the end of the third volume. It is just a magical world, describing this family in 1937 down in a big house in Sussex. A whole cast of characters, each of whom is depicted and imagined and who grows as the series continues. And it's basically a story about them all from 1937 through the war and the aftermath. But she's especially good on the women, and she's terribly good on detail, her descriptions of meals and furnishings. It recreates a world brilliantly.
Latter-day Forsyte saga.
I would say almost a latter-day Jane Austen, actually.
Mm. Francis.
I want to recommend a very underrated novel from about 10 years ago called The Gate of Air by James Buchan, who is himself a very underrated novelist. It's about a software engineer who moves to this very factory farmed countryside and finds that his house is being haunted, a haunting which seems to centre on an extremely louche 1960s picture called Venus in a Groovy Hat, which has come with the house. And it gradually becomes clear that actually he's not having problems with a ghost, he's having problems with the goddess on whose temple 2,000 years ago the house is built. But what's extraordinary about it is the way it's written. It is in this witty, almost epigrammatic, analytical kind of dialogue, sort of stately 18th century novel about now. So what you get is a kind of completely wonderful but bizarre combination of the woman in black crossed with the decline and fall of the Roman Empire.
It sounds excellent, Hazel.
Well, I'm reading in a slightly sort of random way a book called Wave Me Goodbye, edited, in fact, by one of our contributors, Anne Boston. It was first published in 1988, I think, and it's just been reissued by Virago. It's a series of stories by women writers about the Second World War. So it gives you a sort of behind-the-scenes picture, almost, of the war. I mean, there are famous writers, you know, Rosamund Lehman, A.L. Barker, but there are also some unknown writers. And they're all coming at it from a slightly different point of view, but obviously it's about loss and dislocation. And reading them all sort of one after the other, they almost add up to a sort of a novel, because it just gives you this very, very vivid picture of what it was like to be in the Blitz. I find them very gripping, actually.
Thank you. That is it for this month, and indeed for this year. Our thanks to Frances Bufford and to Emily Drabble for being with us. You will find details of all the books we've mentioned today in the show notes attached to this episode on your podcast app or on the website, along with all the Slightly Fox books and the application page to subscribe to the Quarterly magazine. You know you want to. FoxQuarterly.com is the place to go. Thank you for listening and indeed for being with us for the first year of the Slightly Fox Literary Podcast. In that short time, the podcast has been listened to by, well, it's over 120,000 people now, all over the world. It's an amazing thought for such a small publishing house scale, don't you think?
Yes, yes. Given that Hazel and I had no idea what a podcast was when we started.
Now, Gail and Hazel are up for making more, you'll be glad to hear. So we will be back on January 15th with a podcast about New Year reading resolutions. Enjoy Christmas in the meantime and join us then.